The Carters will be broke by then, and Hannah won't stick around if there's no money. And she won't want to be part of another scandal. All that work snagging Harvey for nothing, and those lifelong dreams of money and glamour? Irretrievably gone. Hannah will have to consider all this when I show her the videos. But I will offer her a way out. I will delete all of it if she admits that she lied about what my father did to her. A confession. I'll film that too, of course. I'll say it's for my own security in case they try to discredit me after I delete the videos of her husband's misdemeanors. Step four, distribute her confession far and wide. Obviously. I'm thinking New York Post, Vanity Fair, The New Yorker. Maybe I'll make a deal with one of them for an exclusive. It may have been 10 years ago, but it was a big case at the time. Wilson versus Peterson. People will remember. April is staring at me, her spoon against her bottom lip. "Earth to Claire Peterson," she says, and for a moment I wonder if I spoke out loud. 2 weeks, I say. 3 at the most. Chapter 10. That summer, I had to come home to New York in the middle of camp for an orthodontist appointment that had taken months to secure. My mother picked me up that morning and drove me to my appointment. Then I went home briefly to pick up some more clothes. I barely noticed the slim, shy girl in our house. We exchanged no more than a few words of greeting before my mother drove me back. Then maybe a week later, over one of our phone calls, my mother mentioned she needed to find a new nanny. "Why? What about that girl? What's her name?" "She's gone. She went home." "Already? I thought she was there for the whole summer. What happened?" "I think she was just overwhelmed. She was so young, barely 20. She'd lived her whole life on a farm, you know? So I guess it was too much for her." "I thought that was the point. Didn't you say she wanted to visit museums or whatever?" "Yes, well, I don't think she did that. She was terribly unhappy. Then she asked to go home, so we called her parents and sent her back." Then she told me other news, and I didn't give a single thought to Hannah Wilson for months. Until I found out my parents were being sued in civil court for sexual assault. There were two things that defined my father. He was a businessman, and he worshipped my mother. I think he could never believe his luck that she'd agreed to marry him. He was middle class before he met her, whereas she was the quintessential New York high society woman. I used to think she was the most beautiful woman in the world, head-turningly so. She was also very smart and in many ways as wonderful and privileged as her life was. I think she wanted something else for me. Not a career so much as a calling. Didn't quite work out that way. But he was talented, or so we thought, and his investment firm grew steadily over the years. We were rich, by any standard, which is why she picked us. She went home, back to her pathetic life in Canada, and told her parents that my father had visited her room every night and did things to her. She also said she couldn't tell my mother because he had threatened her. I have no doubt that Hannah Wilson came to us with that plan already in place. She looked for a wealthy family and she found one. She counted on the fact that my parents would not want the publicity and would quickly settle out of court for an undisclosed sum. Just a generic blackmail scam, although impressive in its simplicity. Needless to say, my mother didn't believe a word of it. The idea that my quiet, kind, bespectacled father was capable of whatever she claimed he did was never even considered. And after the initial shock of the betrayal, she returned to her defiant self. She had done so much to accommodate that girl, and this is how she repaid us? She was adamant that the Petersons would not settle. "We will clear our good name," she thundered. So my parents fought back. Hard. They accused her of going after money, which, considering she wanted $10 million in compensation, was the truth. Hannah returned to New York accompanied by her parents for depositions and filings. They looked so out of place, the three of them, in their Sunday best and with their baffled expressions, as if it hadn't been their idea to be here, as if they hadn't made all this happen. By then, the press was having a field day. My father was a monster. Hannah was a naive young girl who had been taken advantage of. My parents countered that she was a gold digger, that she'd even conned her own parents, who looked like good people, they said. The problem was that she presented well in court. She was young, not beautiful, but pretty enough, which was probably better. She looked scared all the time. Even at my young age, I could see that she had that quality that made people want to protect her. So I stepped in. I told my mother that when I'd met Hannah that day, I'd said something like, "I'm sure I'll see you again before you go back," and she said, "I don't think so. I don't intend to stick around here for long." I asked why that was, and she winked at me and whispered, "I got what I wanted. I'm going to go home, and very soon I'll be very rich." I said I didn't even understand what she meant, but I hadn't asked, because why would I? She meant nothing to me. I just wanted to return to my summer camp. It says a lot about the stress my parents were under that they believed me. They immediately called their lawyer, and public opinion began to shift against her. It also helped that they were generous donors, culturally as well as politically. The press remarked that my mother had even volunteered at a soup kitchen one Christmas. My father gave a press conference with all of us by his side, outside the court where he had filed a counterclaim. He spoke words I didn't understand, like malicious prosecution, frivolous claims, and abuse of process. But I nodded in agreement the whole way through. We had done nothing but be kind and generous to her. And this had been a premeditated con, an attempt to blackmail us against a potential scandal, not of our own doing, skillfully carried out by a young woman of dubious character. The dubious character was a reference to the fact that she'd been caught shoplifting two tubes of lipstick with a school friend long ago, and some clever journalist had dug up the story and made it sound like she was part of some criminal gang. And then my father paused for longer than made sense, and when I turned around to look at him, he looked suspended in time. And I'll never forget the look of terror on his face when he turned to my mother. He groaned and clutched at his chest, and before we could do anything, he'd fallen hard on the concrete steps. After that, all I remember are the screams and my mother cradling his head on her lap. By the time the ambulance arrived, he had died. And that was the end of Wilson versus Peterson. The press carried unflattering photos of Hannah above headlines that screamed, "Murderer and con artist." She had killed an upstanding citizen, a man who had given so much to his family, to his church, and to the poor of this city. For a while, people rightly prayed for her head, on talk shows, in line at the checkout. There should be consequences, they said, for what she'd done. But they'd left by then, the three of them, back to their shitty little lives on their farm. The end? No. Evil has many tentacles, and it was not finished with us yet. It turned out that the money that had funded our lavish lifestyle wasn't strictly ours. It belonged to my father's clients. It was amazing that he hadn't been found out at that stage, considering he essentially borrowed from Peter to pay Paul, without telling either Paul or Peter. I've thought a lot about the years when my life was a kaleidoscope of birthday parties, ponies, and tennis lessons, and I can't recall a single occasion where my father was stressed or him admonishing my mother for spending too much. It was the opposite, really. He was always buying us gifts, but now his clients wanted their money back, but there was no money. And that would have been the bigger scandal. Never go after rich people's money. I found out the hard way. They'll forgive you anything except stealing from them. But my mother sold everything and settled with everyone. And under the circumstances and out of respect for my mother, no one made a big fuss. Not long after we buried my father, my mother moved us to a cramped, two-bedroom apartment in Charleston, West Virginia, where she would just lock herself in her room. I would walk in to find her lying in bed with the blinds drawn and an eye mask over her face, like some faded film star. When she emerged, there was a smell about her, acrid and unwashed. Her hair became limp and greasy, and over time matted on the back of her head. She wouldn't eat. She wouldn't speak except to say, "I have to lie down. I have a migraine." Just like she said the day before and the day before that. We had no housekeeper then, no staff, no friends to speak of, no one to help us. I would order us a pizza and pay for it with her credit card. I would think about my dad, about how much I missed him. My little brother would cry himself to sleep. When my mother died alone in that room, the doctors said it was an accidental overdose. But I knew it wasn't. I think she literally felt she had nothing to live for. It goes without saying that I have often thought of doing the same, until Hannah Wilson came back into my life, and life got exciting again. Chapter 11. I move in with the Carters the following week. Hannah takes me to my quarters, as she calls it. It's at the back of the first floor and down half a dozen steps. It's small and cramped and makes my room at April seem like the Taj Mahal. I vaguely wonder whether housekeepers have a union. My uniforms hang in the closet. I had been concerned I might have to dress up in some black pseudo-French frilly type, but I am pleased to find a double-breasted light blue dress with two rows of white buttons all the way down the front and white trim on the collar and sleeves. She must have ordered some new ones specially because there is no way Diane and I are the same size. I also find a number of pinafore aprons, all of them white. Next door to my room is the bathroom and a small gym, equipped with a treadmill, a spin bike, and weights. "That's where I live," she quips. "Harvey had it put in especially for me. Do you think I should be offended?" She chuckles, then pats her hips and adds, "Still trying to lose that post-baby fat. Some days I think it will never happen." I'm at least 20 pounds heavier than she is, but never mind.
"You look great. You've got nothing to worry about," I say.
Except me, obviously.
She smiles. "Thank you."
The last two rooms are the laundry and what she calls the utility room. In there is a cleaning trolley with cloths and spray and feather dusters, which I'm supposed to push around the place as I do my work.
"Everything all right?"
she asks as we go back upstairs. "Everything is terrific," I reply, and she laughs. We both do. Then she takes me on a tour of the house. I make all the right noises. Ooh, ah, even though part of me is a little shocked at how ostentatious everything is. The living room alone, I mean the main living room, because there are a number of living rooms, is larger than April's little apartment downtown. Then there's the view, the tall windows from floor to ceiling that open onto the private terrace facing directly over Central Park. The white wood-paneled walls covered with artwork. Even the ceiling is spectacular. It's a painted sky, all blue and white and pale gold, and it's breathtaking, like a dream. Apart from the bedrooms, there is very little wall space in this place that isn't covered with valuable artwork.
"This is my favorite room in the house," she says when we reach the kitchen.
I doubt that very much, but it's a good line.
"I love this view, overlooking the trees."
She stands back from the tall windows.
"If you stand about here, you might even think you're in the country."
"You might have to put your hands over your ears, too," I say,
and she laughs, a big, genuine laugh. Next is the nursery. It's a perfect room for a baby, with its light pink and light gray color scheme. She tells me that the artist who did the ceiling in the main living room came and painted the mural. It's a little girl walking among wildflowers, carrying a parasol made of butterflies. Mia makes gurgling noises in her crib, and Hannah picks her up. She's wearing a white cotton onesie and wriggles her feet. Hannah brings her belly to her nose and smells her, which strikes me as hilarious and makes me laugh out loud. I know, isn't she the most beautiful girl ever? She coos, as if I'd been laughing out of pure joy at the sight of her. She used to cry all night. Thank God we're past that now. Speaking of which, she shows me a white object that looks like a cheap plastic radio, like something you'd have in the shower. Baby monitor. We have two of them, but yours is different because I couldn't find a video monitor that worked all the way down to your room.
I have one in my room? I blurt, panic rising.
An image of me running up the stairs to Mia in the middle of the night flashes in mind. Then doing it again, and again, and then daylight. She smiles apologetically. It's only if I'm out. When I'm here, you can turn it off or turn it down low. Anyway, this is yours, audio only. I'm still fuming over it when she says, here, you want to try to feed her? And to my horror, she hands me Mia. Sit down. I'll go and fetch her bottle. She walks out, leaving me and Mia together in the armchair. I've never held a baby before. She doesn't cry, which is good. I lift her up, jiggle her little body, get used to her weight, figure out how to sit her down and how to cradle her, sort of. Just enough so I don't look like the complete fraud that I am. Then Hannah returns with the bottle and hands it to me. I mumble something about it being the right temperature, then stick one end in Mia's mouth. I can see you've done this before, she says, and I'm not sure if she's being sarcastic or not, but I wish she'd stop looking at me. Lovely room, I say. Thank you. I insisted we redecorate it.
What did it look like before?
Oh, let me see. Some dark blue and gold damask wallpaper over on that wall. An enormous photograph of a naked woman lying down from the back, across from a four-poster bed with a plum-colored velvet canopy and a huge glass chandelier.
So why did you change it?
I ask, and she cracks up. Can I leave you for a minute? I have a call to make, she says.
Sure.
It's just Mia and me now. We stare into each other's eyes, hers way more trusting than mine. I'm struck by how long her eyelashes are, how thin the skin on her eyelids is, almost translucent, and how utterly perfect she is. Her skin is like porcelain, but warmer. It occurs to me that babies are like a blank slate. They haven't been disappointed yet. They think the world is a happy place, that promises are meant to be kept, and recycling really is a thing. What will be her first letdown, I wonder? Her mother, obviously. She smiles at me, a wide grin, genuine and radiant with happiness, as if she were saying, "Oh, it's you. That's really great." And it's like a current passes through from her to me, and it makes my eyes swim. When Hannah returns and takes her from me, I find myself hanging on just that little bit harder, and Hannah has to give an extra tug. Finally, Hannah introduces me to Mr. Carter. We are in his office, a large room with a big mahogany desk in the center. A bookshelf that takes up all of one wall and frame pages from medieval illuminated manuscripts hanging opposite. The effect is so impressive, I almost curtsy. Harvey Carter is shorter than I expected. He shakes my hand and welcomes me to their home. He
He tells me that he works in a law firm and he's very busy.
You'll hardly ever see me,
he says. His offices are somewhere downtown and he often works late. Occasionally, he'll be needed in the London office for a few days. Hannah adds proudly that he's one of the founding partners, and he coyly brushes her off. He seems like a nice person, with a big, open, friendly face. And when he looks at Hannah, that whole face lights up. I imagine that face when he realizes that he's been had. When she announces over caviar hors d'oeuvres that it's not working and she's leaving him, when he receives the demand for millions of dollars from her very expensive, very adversarial divorce lawyer, when he happens upon the cover of a tabloid and sees his ex-wife sunning herself on a yacht, her toes being sucked by some tanned, ripped stud, and he realizes he's paying for it all, stud included. I feel a wave of outrage on his behalf, and I mentally telegraph to him that it's going to be okay, that it won't come to that, that I've got this, that I'll get to her before she has time to do any damage to him, because while we'll make home videos, Harvey and I, I'll never use them. I'll only need them for leverage, that's all. I'm not an evil person, and I'd never hurt an innocent party. I mentally telegraph that, too, as I stand there, demure and sweet and blushing with shyness. I suspect that's his type. Chapter 12. It's my first morning and my alarm goes off at 6:30. I turn it off and go back to sleep because she said they'll get their own breakfast this morning. And what difference does it make if I get up at 7 or 8 or 9? But then she knocks on my door.
Everything all right, Louise?
And I have to say my alarm hadn't worked.
Won't happen again,
I say, still groggy from sleep. They have phones in almost every room in this house. The system doubles as an intercom, which is how she can call me if she needs me. That first morning, the phone rings and I pick it up, thinking that's what I'm supposed to do, and I'm about to blurt, Carter residence, when I hear her voice on the line.
Hi, Dad.
My heart does a somersault. Her father, that abominable man whose ugly red face has haunted my nightmares ever since I first laid eyes on him. It should have been him who died instead of my father. I think about that often, and then sometimes I think about killing him, too.
He said no, Hannah says. Sorry.
He doesn't say anything for a moment, but I can hear him breathing through his nose, long, loud breaths, like he's gearing up for a fight.
I'm sorry,
she says again.
Don't you want to help your old dad, then?
It's not like that. It's not my money. I can't make him.
He snorts. You rich people are all the same, aren't you? The more you have, the less you want to part with it.
I didn't think you'd end up like that. Not the way we raised you, your mother and me.
Dad, come on. Enough. I would if I could. You know that. It's not my money.
How come it's not your money when you're his wife? I don't know how they do it over there, but where I'm from, married couples share everything. They look after each other. Any money I have is your mother's. She'd know she spends enough of it.
He coughs. It goes on for a while.
Sharing, Hannah, he continues finally, sharing your good fortune. And being honest with each other. That's how marriage works.
What do you really want $50,000 for, Dad? You're not gambling again, are you? You haven't been at the track again. Because I'm not sure you're being honest about what you want the money for.
He pauses. And it goes on for so long that I think maybe he's hung up. But then he speaks again.
Speaking of being honest.
What?
Harvey said something interesting at the wedding. I can't get it out of my mind. Maybe you can help me out. He said, I can't wait to take Hannah around New York. I can't believe she's never been there before. And I thought to myself, well, what a funny thing to say.
You didn't tell him, did you?
She blurts.
That this isn't your first rodeo. Nah, I figured you must have your reasons to lie to your husband.
He sneers.
I have to go, Dad. Mia's crying.
You do that, sweetheart, and don't call us back again. Unless you've got some good news for us, all right? Not that you'll want to anyway. Now that you've got all that money, you should find plenty to keep you occupied. Just don't call here again, all right, sweetheart? You ungrateful witch. I can't believe you'd break your mother's heart. Again, you fucking...
She hangs up on him, and I do the same, but way more gently. I can't believe Hannah has never told her husband about her past. Or maybe I can. Because one thing's for sure, nothing has changed in that family. They're still the same pack of hustlers. Usually, Harvey leaves for work about 8 in the morning, and before he goes, he'll spend maybe 20 minutes in his home office. On my second day, I get in there early and pretend to clean with the feather duster. I don't get the point of those things, since they essentially move dust around from one location to another, inches away. But it's a nice prop. On one shelf are a number of boxes of various shapes and sizes. Some are made of wood, some are covered in cloth. Some are made of porcelain. I open one at random, and it looks like an old set of painting brushes and some strange tarnished metal cigarette holders.
Ah, I see you found my calligraphy collection.
Oh, Mr. Carter, my apologies. I thought you'd already left.
I'm blushing furiously as he comes to stand next to me. He takes out one of the smaller silver tubes, opens one end of it, pulling out the stopper and drops the contents into his hand.
These are antique nibs, Arabic. See how sharp the edge is? That's how they get the type of stroke.
He turns around and points with his chin at one of the artworks on the wall covered with strange lettering, then carefully puts the nibs away.
Calligraphy is a bit of a hobby of mine, he says, although I don't use these, of course.
He opens a long wooden box in which are various inks and nibs and fountain pens, all snugly set inside a dark red cushiony lining. They're beautiful, I say. He nods. Did you do any of these? I point to the various framed calligraphy works. He chuckles.
No, I'm still working up to that. Maybe one day.
He puts the boxes back and picks up a stack of papers from the desk. I'm still feeling embarrassed at having been caught out, but relieved he doesn't seem to mind. Then I figure I may as well make the most of the situation.
I'll get out of the way, Mr. Carter. I can finish later.
He returns to his papers and I turn around and quickly undo the second button of my blouse so it gapes in the right place. Then I blow off a little speck of dust from the top of a bronze angel's head to show I take pride in my work. I walk past him and, quote, accidentally, end quote, brush my tits against his arm. He looks at me and frowns. I apologize, but my eyes don't leave his. Now, I don't expect Harvey Carter to fall in love with me, obviously, but I am hinting at a free offering. A little gift from me to the master of the house. And it's not usually that hard. I remember back when I was in high school, public high school, and living with Cousin Emily. Her awful kids always got great grades in everything in their private independent school, where they studied things like flower arrangement and pottery. I still remember going to see my cousin Sasha perform some idiotic contemporary dance thing with flowers in her hair, while her brother Todd played the violin very badly in the crappy student orchestra. And afterward, all the adults agreed that they were geniuses. The night before the next concert, I broke Todd's violin strings using a pair of nail clippers. He didn't realize until he pulled the instrument out before walking out on stage. They never figured out it was me. They accused some other kid who apparently was jealous of Todd's talent. As if those kids really had any talent to begin with. Anyway, the point is my own grades were not that good. Orphan, public school, surprise, surprise. And one day Cousin Emily imposed a curfew on me until things improved. I was 15 years old and the only subject I liked and was good at was creative writing. It was run by our English teacher, Mr. Clegg, who found me after class one afternoon crying in the hallway and took me back to the empty classroom, closed the door, and asked me what on earth was the matter. I told him through sobs how much I hated Cousin Emily. I'd fallen in love with the books of Charlotte Bronte and told him that my life was like Jane Eyre's, only much worse. He nodded a lot and kept licking his lips. He had very fat lips, thick and plum-colored. Then he asked me to unbutton my blouse so he could see my breasts. I was shocked. I said no. But then he said how beautiful I was and how he thought about me all the time. So I did as he asked. I was also a little in love with Mr. Clegg, and by the time I went home, I was determined to lose weight for the wedding and was picking names for our children. Mr. Clegg was already married and had children of his own, but I decided he was terribly unhappy, and that was Mrs. Clegg's fault, and that I would never, ever make Mr. Clegg unhappy. When I think of this now, I cringe. Surely, these were the fantasies of a much younger girl. Anyway, I didn't stay naive for long. I discovered that if you love someone, they might not love you back. But if you do what they say, they will like you for a while. And take care of your grades. Hooray. Anyway, back to Harvey Carter. He smiles at me quickly, in the way people do when they just want to get away, but they don't want to be rude, and he's gathered his papers, and he's gone now. I don't usually get this wrong, and I wonder if I've lost my touch. This is very annoying because I need Harvey Carter to play his part, and I bite my knuckle hard enough to leave the imprint of my teeth around it. Chapter 13. It's been 3 days, and it goes without saying that I hate this job already. Harvey is working long hours, and I haven't been able to get any time alone with him. Not even 10 minutes. I never do any actual cleaning, obviously. I just shake my feather duster here and there and call it work. Same with the vacuuming. Just push it around a bit. Maybe dab some fake sweat on my brow whenever she walks past. But it's still a strange feeling to catch sight of myself in the mirror, a lint-free cotton cloth in one hand and a jar of Danish wax furniture polish in the other. It makes me want to do something crazy like eat the contents of the jar and then puke all over the Louis XV commode. See if that makes it shine. But then I remind myself why I am here, and then I feel better. I got to check out her bathroom today, all under the cover of cleaning it. I love her bathroom. It's large and light with a Moroccan feel because of the blue and white tiles and the light fixtures. Visible through an arched doorway is the gorgeous freestanding bathtub sitting under the window. I imagine myself lying in that bathtub, bubbles up to my chin, turning the tap off with my pedicured toe. I found some Ambien and some Xanax in the bathroom cabinet, and normally I'd swipe them both, but not this time. I did help myself to a Xanax, though. God knows I need it. I have to come up with all sorts of ways to hide my duplicity. I know that Hannah doesn't cook, and neither do I, obviously, but Louise Martin does. She wouldn't have been hired otherwise. Fortunately, they do their own breakfast and Harvey isn't at home for lunch, so Hannah will usually fix herself a sandwich. For dinner, I'll buy things like fettuccine in a packet and a jar of gourmet pasta sauce from Fairway, or some frozen veal cordon bleu that comes in a box and goes in the microwave. In the kitchen, I'll line up ingredients more or less randomly on the countertop, as if making something from scratch, just in case. I'll even drop an olive on the floor and sprinkle herbs over the stove. Yesterday, I opened a jar of tomato paste and noticed it had a small gray round of mold on the top. Now, I'm the type of person who, at this point, would throw the whole jar away. This time, I carefully scooped the mold with a wooden spoon and added it to the ready-made sauce that was gently warming on the stove. Sometimes she'll come into the kitchen just to have a chat. So yesterday, I said to her that I don't like people hovering when I'm cooking. I said it in the nicest way.
It's just a quirk I have. Fortunately for me, Mrs. Van Kemp didn't mind one bit. Oh, no problem. I'll keep out of your way then.
If only. One thing about Hannah is that she has no friends except for a woman called Erin, who knows Harvey from way back and is only a few years younger than Hannah. So
Harvey thought we'd make great friends. The way people do with children of the same height,
is how she described it to me.
And I'm not sure, but I think she wants my husband, she added, whispering.
Really?
She shrugged. Just a feeling. And the way she is around him, like a butterfly. Although she is quite beautiful, she sighed.
Does it bother you? I asked.
Please say yes.
That she likes Harvey?
No.
Why should it? Harvey could have had her. He chose me, so.
She smiled coyly from one side of her mouth. I don't know why Hannah tells me these things. Maybe it's because she's so friendless and lonely. She follows me around like a puppy. I vacuumed the stairs this morning because I'm worried she'll notice I'm not doing any work, and also to shut her up because when she's not sleeping, which she seems to do an awful lot of, she talks, like, all the time. I don't usually have people to talk to, except maybe April. And even then, it's not like we chew each other's ear off for hours on end. So being around Hannah is taking some getting used to. It's the middle of the afternoon, and I'm fake sweeping the terrace. It's pretty spectacular up here. The terrace runs the entire length of the building. It's large, with a stone floor, and in lieu of a railing is a low wall of brick pavers with green potted plants along it. If I lived in this house, I'd spend all my days here. Hannah appears in the French doors.
Ha, there you are. I'm making myself a coffee. Would you like one?
Mia is asleep, thank God. I follow her to the kitchen, thinking she wants me to make the coffee, but no. She tells me to sit down, puts a plate of chocolate chip cookies in front of me, and pops a capsule in the coffee machine. When we both have our steaming cups in front of us, she sits down at the stool opposite me, puts her bare feet on the bar, and starts nibbling on the edge of a cookie. How did you meet Mr. Carter? I ask, resisting the urge to shove the entire cookie in my mouth at once. She smiles.
I used to have a flower store in Toronto. That's where I used to live. He was visiting on business, and he came by to buy some flowers.
Is that it? I ask after a moment. She laughs.
It was the end of the day, and I was locking up, and suddenly he was there, knocking on the door, breathless. He gave me the same spiel I'd heard so many times over the years. Please, don't lock up. I need to buy some flowers. It's an emergency. Invariably, the emergency is that they've only just realized it's their wedding anniversary and they need flowers right now.
Makes sense, I say, reaching for another cookie.
I said no, the flowers are already in the cooler. I told him to go to the supermarket. They have flowers there. He was very insistent. He wanted something special.
He said that a colleague of his had just had a terrible day and needed cheering up. At least that was different, so I asked what had happened, and he said her cat had been run over. I had a cat. I loved my cat, so I gave in. I brought out an arrangement of birds of paradise and calla lilies. He said it was perfect, and he couldn't thank me enough. Then he came in again the next day and bought a small plant for the apartment he was staying in. He explained he was only here for a short time on business, and the apartment he rented needed cheering up.
Like the colleague with the cat, I say.
That's what I said. I asked if the bouquet was well received, and he said, absolutely. My colleague feels much better because of them, and I expect my apartment to do the same. Which I thought was pretty funny. Then he came a third time, and this time he asked what my favorite flowers were. I don't have a favorite flower. They're all special in their own way. But I played along. I love violets, but they don't last long. Sweet peas are one of my favorites, but I didn't have any to sell. Tulips are special, an underrated flower that comes in all sorts of varieties. People don't like them in vases because they tend to droop. They think the flowers are dying, but that's not true. That's just the way they are, which makes very beautiful cascading bouquets if you cut them in different lengths.
She pauses to take a sip of coffee, and I'm trying to understand why we are talking about flowers, if we will ever get to the point, and if there is a point at all.
I showed him the burning heart variety, she continues, yellow and red with big swirls of color. He bought 2 dozen of them, then after I had finished preparing the bouquet. He offered it to me with a flourish. Will you come out with me, he asked, for a drink? I'd just been dumped by my not very nice boyfriend. His name was Barnaby. And by the time I found out he was cheating on me, it had been going on for months, which made me not the brightest tool in the shed, as my father would say. She rolls her eyes. So Harvey walked into my life, brandishing a bouquet of burning heart tulips. That first night, he took me to the Ritz-Carlton for cocktails and Jacob's for dinner. I can safely say I'd never set foot in such places. My dates so far had been more of the, let's have a beer at the local sports bar, it's curling night. I laugh at that.
Would you mind if I had a cigarette? She blurts.
Here? Now?
It's the coffee. It makes me crave nicotine. If it bothers you, I won't. I shouldn't anyway. Owen, Harvey thinks I've given up.
Which I have, she hastens to say.
I didn't smoke at all once I found out I was pregnant. But I've been sneaking one here and there lately. He'll kill me if he found out.
I shrug. It doesn't bother me. It's your house. She gets up and pulls out one of the cookbooks on the shelf and retrieves a pack of Marlboro, a lighter, and an ashtray. Then she opens the window and sits down again.
Promise you won't tell?
She asks, cigarette already in her mouth. My lips are sealed.
Thank you.
She takes a drag.
That's better, she says, exhaling a thin column of smoke. I wasn't used to men like Harvey. Men who open the door for you, who help you put your coat on.
I hate that, I say. It just makes it harder. She smiles. So what happened? If you were there and he was here?
I didn't expect our little romance to go beyond his business trip. But then he extended his stay. When he left, he promised to come back. I didn't really believe him. But he did come back. Then every time he'd leave, I'd think, okay, this is it. This is the end. But he kept coming back to me. We spent many wonderful nights together in my small apartment. He was different. He made me laugh. He was charming and interesting and kind. Then he asked me to marry him. What can I say? By then I was in love, head over heels, and pregnant with Mia.
She smiles, but there's something sad at the edges of her eyes. She stubs out the cigarette. Of course she was pregnant. I can just imagine how she made herself into everything he wanted, seductive and sweet at the same time. She'd gush that having sex in the missionary position for 5 minutes was the most thrilling experience of her life. Then somehow, against all odds and statistics, she got pregnant, accidentally, and Harvey being a gentleman. Well, as they say, the rest is history.
I was 30 years old when I met him. It's not old, but still, I thought my life's direction had been set by then. I did begin to worry about whether I'd ever have a family. I hadn't met the right man yet, and while I wasn't holding out for Prince Charming, I thought it would be nice to meet someone reliable, someone who could hold down a job, someone who didn't feel the need to lie all the time. So while I might have expected the compass needle of my life to swing a few degrees here or there, a few minor detours, I sure didn't expect this. I didn't expect Harvey.
I bet you had a nice wedding. She smiles. I can barely remember it, even when I look at the pictures.
In the church, we had to do away with the tradition of his side, her side of the aisle, as I had only a smattering of people attend. Harvey had a list of over 200, although I think at least half of those were acquaintances of his mother's.
People we must invite, Harvey, darling. They'll never forgive us, Patsy had said.
I'm surprised at the sharpness of her tone when she talks about Harvey's mother. I take it you're not close, I ask. She lights up another cigarette.
She doesn't like me. I mentioned it to Harvey once early on, and he said I was being overly sensitive.
His mother doesn't like a lot of people, he said.
I don't know why he thought that would make me feel better, considering she adores his first wife.
There's a first wife? I ask, innocent-like.
Serena. I never met her. She moved to London after the divorce. But his mother took a long time to forgive Harvey for divorcing her.
Such a lovely woman, and beautiful, too. A true sense of style,
is how she referred to Serena at my own wedding. I raise my eyebrows. Awkward.
That's one of the reasons Patsy doesn't like me. Harvey left Serena for me, you see.
My eyebrows shoot up. Harvey was still married when you met him? She cringes a little, then recovers quickly.
I didn't know he was still married. By the time I found out, they were already going through the divorce. But it didn't take long. It was amicable.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, my parents came to the wedding, of course. In all the photos, they look really happy, which is a miracle in itself. My mother in her green silk dress and, oddly, white gloves. My father with red cheeks and his light gray suit. The same gray suit he brings out for every special occasion. I remember thinking it was stretching worryingly around his waist, just like me. She chuckles.
Still, it was sweet.
They kept telling me how proud they were, like I'd achieved something really significant.
Of course they were proud. She'd finally caught the big fish. Then I think of the phone conversation she had with her father. And I wonder how he feels now. Hannah empties the ashtray into the trash and says she's going to lie down. I guess it's all the lies that take it out of her. I tell her not to worry. I'll feed Mia when she wakes up. Still, that was a good story, and she told it well. If I didn't know any better, I'd almost believe it.
Chapter 14. The next day, Hannah goes out. I don't know where to. To her therapist, no doubt. It's the first time I'm alone here, and I've been dying to go through her things, especially her bedroom. But of course I haven't, because she's always here. So the moment she leaves, I almost run upstairs. I start with the dresser.
It's clearly hers, some kind of antique thing with a big mirror on top and lots of little drawers. There's a photo in a pretty silver frame of her with Harvey on a vacation somewhere. He looks very relaxed, very proud, with his arm around his wife's waist. She's heavily pregnant and her face is more puffy than it is now. She stands with one hand on her stomach, looking at him in puppy-like adoration. I pick it up to take a closer look at her. You'd never know, looking at those big eyes and that pretty, smiling mouth, what an evil heart she carries within. She's got some nice beauty creams, which I help myself to. I try on some green eyeshadow and pocket a Dior lipstick from the back of the drawer. They have two walk-in closets, his and hers. He has conservative tastes, it must be said. Nice suits, hanging according to season and color. Lots of shirts, white ones, some with stripes. Her clothes, on the other hand, are surprisingly ordinary and barely fill a third of her space. Although I notice some new shoes, very nice, expensive, definitely. Then I get it. Of course she's trying to lose weight before she splurges on a new wardrobe. I spot the dress I saw her buy at Bergdorf Goodman's the day I followed her. It's a black lace cocktail dress with a nice edge to the décolletage, and a brilliant idea flashes in my mind. Since she's so insecure about her weight, I'm going to sew inside the seam. I'm already laughing at the thought of her putting it on and finding it doesn't fit anymore. I take it downstairs to the laundry. There's a sewing machine there, all set up on the bench. It takes a bit of Googling to find out how to use the machine, and I use a dust cloth to practice on. Then I line up one edge under the bit of metal and press the pedal. And within seconds, the dress is getting pounded by the needle, like a doll-sized jackhammer. But it's not right, and I pull on the fabric to release it. But it's stuck. The thread has knotted itself into a tight ball. I'm starting to sweat. This is not going the way I imagined. This is turning out to be a really bad idea. What if she comes home now? How am I going to explain this? I can't exactly say it required mending. By the looks of it, she's never worn it before. I wish I'd popped another one of her Xanax before I started this, because it's really stressing me out. But Mrs. Peterson did not raise a quitter, and an hour later it is done. I return the dress, looking a little worse for wear, it must be said, where I found it. And then I go to check on Mia. She's awake and perfectly happy. I pick her up and she giggles at me, puts her little chubby hands on my face and frowns in concentration, like she's exploring me. I keep her in my arms while I search the rest of the house, although without much urgency. But I do find a credit card statement belonging to Serena Carter from a UK bank, hidden between two of Harvey's legal books on the shelf. She doesn't spend much. He's scribbled paid on one of them, and I note that the statement is only 6 months old, which means Harvey Carter is still paying his ex-wife's bills, and he's hiding it from Hannah. Now that's interesting. Mia yawns and rests her head in the crook of my neck. And it feels so nice that I stand there, swaying slowly and even forget about Hannah for a while. So when she comes home, I barely have time to put the statements back. Maybe Harvey Carter is still in love with his first wife. Maybe he's suffering from buyer's remorse. Why else would he hide the fact that he's paying her bills? In fact, why else would he pay her bills in the first place? They don't have children. She's a professional woman. Surely she earns a good living. Maybe Hannah can sense it. Maybe that's why she has this thing about Serena. I had another go at seducing him yesterday in a less subtle manner, because time is not on my side. He was in the small sitting room downstairs and Hannah was in bed, where else, so I walked in with the top three buttons of my uniform undone. But this time I wasn't wearing a bra. Any more than three buttons and my tits would be falling out. I leaned against the door jamb and put one hand on my waist in what I would call a very suggestive pose, one that left little to the imagination.
"Is there anything I can do for you, Mr. Carter? Anything at all?"
I asked, chewing on a fingernail. He looked up from his newspaper, blinked a few times, and blushed. Then he went back to reading and said,
"No, thank you, Louise. Maybe Mrs. Carter would like some herbal tea."
I turned around, too angry to be embarrassed, and left him there. I didn't check whether Mrs. Carter wanted some tea. It goes without saying. But it's beginning to look like I'm wasting my time here. I'm almost at the end of the first week and no closer than I was when I started. Except here I am, changing her sheets because apparently that's on my schedule, and she had to remind me because I didn't do it last Tuesday. So I guess the joke's on me. I need a different plan. I liked the original because using Hannah's own strategy against her had a nice symmetry to it. But maybe I'm overcomplicating things. Maybe I should just point a gun to her head and get her confession that way. I wonder where I could get a gun. I bet she owns one. Harvey would have bought it for her. A nice compact little thing. A Glock, most likely. Something pretty and feminine, just like her. Maybe with a pearl handle or something. I peer over the balustrade, but there's no sign of her. I figure she's still downstairs at her computer, where I left her earlier. So I search Harvey's closet first. I'll say I'm tidying up if she comes in. I run my fingers along the back wall behind the hanging suits. I check the shelves and inside the shoes, but there's nothing that doesn't belong there. I do the same in her walk-in closet, and behind the bottom shelf, I see a line in the wall that shouldn't be there. I look more closely. It's some kind of panel. I run my fingers along its edges, my pulse racing. I push softly and it clicks open. I'm grinning. I'm thinking, gun, obviously. Totally gun. Again, I make sure she's nowhere near the bedroom. Then I pull open the panel and reach into the cavity. It's not a gun. It's a leather notebook with a thin leather strap, as thin as a shoelace, wrapped around it. I untie it and a cream-colored card falls out. I pick it up, turn it around. It's her wedding invitation. I open the notebook and flick through the pages. It's better than a gun. It's her diary. I still wake up some nights wondering where I am, but it's different now. Before, I would run my hands over the sheets with their 1 trillion thread count and smile to myself. I'm in our bedroom, in our enormous bed. I'm home. Then I would reach out until my fingers brushed against some part of Harvey. His back, probably, or his arm. He would be asleep because he always sleeps, no matter what. I would press myself against him, maybe move one of the many down pillows and shift it under my head. Or I would raise myself on one elbow and whisper sweet nothings into his ear, kiss his neck softly. Now, more often than not, when I wake in the dead of night, it's because my heart is hammering, and I am overcome with absolute certainty that something is very wrong. I don't reach for Harvey because, as much as he tries, he can't help me. He'll tell me that I'm dreaming and that I should go back to sleep. He doesn't understand how relentless and absolute this feeling of doom is, like we're drifting toward disaster, gathering up speed and we're all blindfolded. I don't even know what the danger looks like, only that I have to stop it before we reach it. Harvey says I've been like this ever since Mia was born. I don't think I have. Mia is almost 3 months old now, but I was fine after she was born, I'm sure of it. I tell him that, but he just shakes his head.
He says Dr. Malone is excellent, the best, and she can help me. He says that I'm suffering from anxiety attacks. He says everything is going to be fine, that he's there for me no matter what. It's normal, he says. It will pass. Dr. Malone has very small eyes, like two black buttons too close together. But it gives her a weird piercing quality, like she has laser focus and can read my mind. Is this what maternal love feels like? I asked. Then with a chuckle, I added, if so, it's going to be a very long 18 years. I meant to lighten the mood. Look at me.